everyone, and welcome to episode 19 of season 11 of Movie Robin at the Daily Podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 award-winning HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again, it's been almost a week since he's been on, but now, you know, he's come back for another episode, is Chris Henry of the Apollo 13 Minute. Welcome back, Chris.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back on with you and talking about a subject near and dear to my heart.
Yes, that I know. I mean, we talked a lot about the airplanes last week when you were on, but today we'll continue with D-Day itself.
Absolutely.
So episode 19 begins with an airplane and the men getting engulfed in flames. So we ended things yesterday with Meehan's plane getting hit, and the pilot saying, "Tell Meehan to get them out of there," and they don't have time, and the plane just gets engulfed in flames, and we now know Meehan's fate, from this particular shot. I mean, it's very poignant, but it's also to the point. It's showing us the dangers. They haven't even landed, and things like this are going on. So it's just nicely done from a realistic perspective, obviously.
It absolutely is, and I think it's interesting. You and I were just talking about it this when we were setting up, but it's shown to us, that Meehan had gone down. And we know it, but think about how scrambled everything probably was, where the guy who's supposed to be the guy up front, the point man, is immediately taken out of the situation. Imagine just going into a normal workplace, an office environment, where your boss, the person who's supposed to hold down the fort, is immediately, without notice, taken out of it. And suddenly, you're starting on the wrong foot. You're starting this impossible task that you're supposed to go on, this incredible historic mission. And right off the bat, the guy that's supposed to be up front showing you where to go is gone. That speaks highly to the leadership that was beneath him with people like Winters.
Correct. I mean, again, it's also a military way of looking at things. I mean, I don't know if you've either read the book or seen the movie We Were Soldiers.
Oh yeah.
So one of the things that the main character played by Mel Gibson points out is that he wants every man to learn the tasks of everyone in front of them and behind them, so that if someone gets taken out, they can take over for them. And that's exactly what happens here. I mean, Winters, we'll see next week when we talk about this even more, Winters is thrown into into this position where he's now the one who's going to be in charge, but he immediately shows everyone that he knows what he's doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean,
it works really well.
Well, and as you saw, in earlier episodes, there was so much belief in his leadership that people went to bat for him, the NCOs underneath him. So, I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's, having actually gotten a chance to interview the real Winters, I understand how those people felt that way. He is one of the people that I use as an example of the most correct casting that Hollywood got right. Because when you talk to him, it was just like you were talking to the guy who played him. It was a very, very accurate depiction.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Damian Lewis or not?
I've talked to Damian Lewis. I never got to meet him in person. But I got the chance to talk with the real Winters, and being from Pennsylvania, that wasn't too far of an excursion out to do an interview with him. It was just a short interview, but man, it was powerful. People don't take long to leave an imprint on you. And he was certainly like that. I the entire interview, I don't think I ever heard him say the word "I." It was always "my men" or "easy company." Really, really humble, soft-spoken guy. I mean, it was very wild just how accurate they got that. One of the things I always joke around with is that I think Garnier is one of the chances where Hollywood, Hollywood always, they always say it, Hollywood's up the story, right? So, they punch up the story, make it more exciting. I think they actually toned Garnier down. So he was even larger than life than he was in the movie, so, or in the miniseries. So, but Winners, boy, they just nailed that right to the T.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I've heard that they got a lot of the men really, really perfectly. But could it be because Damian Lewis spent time with Winters? Do you think that's part
Oh,
of it?
I think it actually is. And I know if you ever get the chance, if you have the, I'm old, so I like having physical copies of stuff, and so I have the DVD and the Blu-rays of Band of Brothers. And if you are like me and you have that, and you go and watch the special features, one of the special features is the gentleman who plays Lewis Nixon. I'm forgetting his name at the moment.
Ron Livingston.
Ron Livingston, he made a video
Diary,
diary.
video diary. Yeah.
It is fantastic. In one of the episodes, he gets to interview, I think it's Winters, just on the telephone. And when he's done, he's exhausted. Like, he was so emotionally into it. He's like, oh my God, like this, wow, like this guy is larger than life. And I absolutely think, I know Damian Lewis and him actually formed a friendship. They were very tight friends. As a matter of fact, when they dedicated the memorial to Winters over there in England, he was there for the unveiling. And then when they made a documentary about Dick Winters, Lewis Nixon, or I'm sorry, Damian Lewis narrated it. He was the narrator for the mini for the documentary they did. I know he had a big impression on Damian Lewis for sure.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't think you get to spend time with Dick and he didn't leave an impression on you, and he really left you wanting to be a better person. If that
Wow.
hopefully doesn't sound cheesy, but he, when you there's only two people I've ever spent time with that I spent time with them and then afterwards really had that feeling of I need to do things differently or better, and one was Dick Winters and the other one was Frank Borman. Those are the
You know,
two that.
I was thinking you were going to say Frank Moore.
Yeah.
I really believe that was what you were going to say.
Yeah, those are the two that really I've gotten to spend time with some great people doing what I do here, but those are the two that in my world were life-changing to spend some time with.
That's just amazing. That's amazing. Yeah, and were you able to record the interviews with them?
It was not. It was. I took all the notes. I still have all my notes from it. But it was just it was just literally me interviewing him. And I wrote an article, for I think it was for the Air Force Museum where I was volunteering with at the time. We had a newsletter that would go out, and I mean it was something I thought I really wanted to go do. But it was a good project. I got to interview some really neat people doing that, and he was one of them. And then he ended up hooking me in with Garnier and Heffron and a few of the others that I got to interview. And I actually got to go to an air show with them, which was hilarious. So,
Oh, wow.
yeah. Garnier and Heffron were a, they could have had their own comedy show and taken on the road.
Oh, wow. That's just really amazing. You know, we get to see that the plane just explodes, and we see one of the pilots go, "Oh, Jesus Christ, 2 o'clock, hold it steady." And then we get a shot of Winters debating what to do, and he just says to his men, he says, "Just go." And then one of the soldiers goes, "I want to jump, sir." And he goes, "Now listen to me. Stay on the plane. You're not jumping." And then someone else goes, "He's okay." And he goes, "No, sir, no." All right, son of a bitch. So, I mean, from my perspective, if I was in a plane like that, I don't know if I would want to take the chance. I don't think it's safer to be in the plane than to jump out of it.
Well, it what's interesting is a lot of folks don't know. So think about what type of airplane it is and where they've put it. And this is something that a lot of folks don't think about when we think about D-Day, is those are transport airplanes, those are cargo planes. Those airplanes have no business being where they are as far as they're in enemy. They're right in the line of fire. That's not what we do with cargo planes. You know, our cargo planes, sure, sometimes, you know, enemy fighters would find them on a delivery route and shoot them down or something, but we didn't put transport planes. You know, they're basically flying like a B-17 would, getting flak and everything. And that's not what we did with those aircraft. Those pilots were not trained to take any aircraft fire. A
And
lot
that
of them.
we can tell by the reactions of the pilots. So over the next
Yeah.
minute or two, we see that these guys are not used to being in combat.
Right.
You
Yeah,
know.
they are not combat pilots. I mean, a lot of them were actually taken straight from the airlines. The airlines would, you know, who was the biggest purchaser of DC-3 airframes? That was the airlines, you know, prior to the war, when the military started buying the C-47, the military version of that airplane. And because we were catching up in production, they said, well, you know what? We are going to work the military just stepped in and said, we are just going to take it. So they would just step in, take the airplanes, and sometimes take the crews, which is really interesting. So a lot of these pilots were not even military pilots. A lot of them were just sort of airline pilots that were sort of forced into military service. They went through a little bit of training, and now they're flying into anti-aircraft fire on D-Day. Totally insane. And I mean, you know, it'd be like putting me in D-Day, you know, and I would, you know,
Completely.
I just like, I'm just gonna die. So
And then we had another shot. Well, first of all, we see the plane actually take a dive and hit the ground and explode. Then we're back in a different cockpit, and one of the guys goes, "Where's the goddamn DZ?" And someone goes, "Maybe it's 3 more minutes on this bearing." He goes, "We get any lower, we ain't gonna need any friggin' parachutes." You slow down. We gotta get some altitude. They can't jump at this speed. He goes, "We there?" And the pilot tries to pull the plane up a little bit, and then we see that the co-pilot just gets his head gun's completely blown off from some of the flak that they get hit with, which proves your point of what you were talking about, how you know these planes were not fitted for combat, and neither were the pilots. And the reaction of the pilot is, "Oh God, oh no." And then what does he do? He just hits the switch to give them the green light. And Winter sees it and goes, "Let's go." And he's the first one out. You know, everyone else jumps out after him. And they do an amazing job of giving us the POV from Winters. You see his perspective as he's outside of the plane, plummeting down to the ground, using a parachute, but still you see, I mean, again, it's amazing CGI, the number of parachutes and the number of planes that are on fire and all you see all the flak and all that stuff. I mean, it's scary as hell just watching that.
oh, I couldn't imagine being in a parachute so vulnerable in that. I mean, you're just floating in a chute, you know, hoping a piece of flak doesn't get you, hoping an airplane doesn't fall and take you out. You know, remember, this is really the there was one experience the Americans had prior to this where they did a jump, but this is really the first of this scale, and certainly, you know, at night. Jumping into enemy territory, so there's a lot of unknowns you're already doing. Again, there was one in the Mediterranean. They did one assault similar to this as a sort of a stage setting training mission. It was actual combat, but they were sort of testing out the theory that this would work. So I mean, a lot going on. And then I love the way that this was able to set the tone and show you how big everything was, you know. And I think that's what they really did right with, when you think of Saving Private Ryan, and then not long after this, is they showed you how big D-Day was. It wasn't, you know, so many other war movies, you're just kind of in this one unit, you know, and they're really focused on this unit. And they did that here. I mean, you're in the 506 almost the whole time, but they show you these moments of you know, they do kind of a 360 of Winters in the chute, And you're like, oh my God. I mean, not only is it terrifying, but it's this massive operation. And I love, the way they captured anti-aircraft fire and the planes and everything. You're going to hear this multiple times from me, by the way, and I apologize now.
No need to
But
apologize.
I really do feel that Band of Brothers is the finest miniseries ever made.
I completely agree with you. Wait, but you like it better than From the Earth to the Moon.
I
Interesting.
do. I do. I have to admit it. I'm sorry for my space fans listening. From the Earth to the Moon was wonderful, and they did a great job. And it does hurt me to say that Band of Brothers is better. But it's not that it's better. I mean, I think it's just different.
No, of course.
But and what I, and how I explain this to everybody is I always tell them, if you want to find out if you like Band of Brothers, go and watch Saving Private Ryan, and that'll give you the feel. But I feel, and this could be controversial, I actually feel that Band of Brothers is way better than Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, for sure.
Totally different. I mean, you got.
I've done Saving Private Ryan minute by minute also, and I will agree with that statement.
Yeah.
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 But
And I do the same thing on a.
what's fair is that if Saving Private Ryan wouldn't have been made, Band of Brothers never would have been made.
You're absolutely right. You're
Saving Private
absolutely right. And I
Ryan
love it.
showed the world that people were still interested in
Yeah.
watching stories about World War II soldiers.
Well,
And
and Saving Private Ryan helped get the World War II Memorial built. I mean, it really did. I mean, it was that interest level, and Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, with Spielberg and Tom Hanks' involvement, that really helped get that memorial built, which there was no World War II memorial in DC. So what I always tell everybody is, if you watch Saving Private Ryan, if you like it, you're going to love Band of Brothers. And I do the same with From, I almost said For All Mankind, totally different.
That's enough.
But
I also love For All Mankind.
I did too, yeah. But when we talk about From the Earth to the Moon, I always tell them, go watch Apollo 13. And if you liked Apollo 13, you're gonna love From the Earth to the Moon. Go watch that next. So I always tell everybody, like, here's a easy watch, and if you like that, now you're gonna want to go and watch these other series. And I always tell everybody that From the Earth to the Moon is Band of Brothers for the space program. Is what I describe it as. So.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you on that. I wonder what Jim's response would be, whether which of the two he likes better.
Oh, that we might have to get him on the we might have to try that and see what,
Well, he's gonna be
really.
on towards the end of of this season, so I'll have to
I want
try to feel him out beforehand, see what he thinks.
Well, what would be fun is if he answers anything but from the earth, if he doesn't reply from the earth to the moon, I should have a quick call in, and then I can challenge him, like, what are you talking about? You're betraying me. So that'd be a lot of fun, but super cool.
No, but I love both of them, From the Earth to the Moon and Band of Brothers. So, Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg knew how to make miniseries, following movies that that worked well for them.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And when we talk about how good this was, there was just something about this because, shortly after here they did the Pacific. I love the Pacific as well, a miniseries about obviously the Pacific Theater of World War II. And I know they did this on purpose, but it just felt different. You didn't feel the same way you did with this one. And that was an actual decision that they made, but it was just so there's just something so special about Band of Brothers. I think it was because maybe it was also because so many of the guys were still alive, and were part of the production. There's actually a couple small scenes where you actually see Babe Heffron. They have him as an Easter egg in one of the scenes.
Yes, he's when they're liberating Holland. He's there sitting
I
there
don't want
like
to give that. I won't steal from someone else's feed, but yeah, it's a but and then, to be honest, I could watch the final disc of this is the documentary
Yes,
that
of
they
course.
did with these guys, and that in itself would have been a stand-up thing to put to theater. I mean, I'd watch that all day long. So
For sure.
it's just
You
such a
get
well done. I
to meet the real men, so that trumps having to watch
well
the video of the documentary of them. Obviously,
well and
25 years later, the documentary is all we have left, but since
yeah
we can't talk to them directly, but still.
One of the things, a telling way to tell if you did a good job, and this is something that in some crazy universe, if Tom Hanks ever heard this, the way to tell if you did a good job with something is if the people that you were attempting to honor with it are proud of it. And the guys in Easy Company, the veterans that I ever got to talk to, were extremely proud of Band of Brothers. And that speaks volumes. I mean, that is, you know, there's only ever been a few people that I talked to. Apollo 13 is another one where, you know, Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes and those guys and Gene Kranz felt that it was, they were proud of it. They thought it did great. Black Hawk Down was another one. Mike Durant told me that he thought that was a really good depiction of what happened. But when you make something and the people you're trying to honor are very proud of it, that's it, man. You don't get a higher praise than that. It doesn't
That's
matter
true.
What the box office says, you know.
It's very true. That's very true. We follow Winters down as he hits the ground and, you know, immediately sets himself up, maneuvers himself into a safe position, and quickly takes off his parachute, moves around, and starts moving a little bit. And then he hears someone coming and he goes, "Flash." And the response he gets back is, and he goes, "I don't think that's the correct reply, Trooper. I say Flash, you say Thunder." He goes, "Yes, sir. Thunder, sir." So it's nice that they they give us that little joke there, you know, also showing that Winters has a sense of humor and knows what's going on. I mean, I'm assuming you've seen The Longest Day. The Longest Day has, you know, issues. You know, there are parts where characters get the Flash and Thunder wrong and end up getting shot. So, you know, or the clicking, which we'll talk about in a little while too.
Yeah, I have some cool stories on the clicking, and it was funny when I talked to Garnier. They always said that Garnier wouldn't do the Flash and Thunder thing. He would sneak up behind you and just ask, "Whose side are you on?" And and if you didn't answer in English, you had a bad night. So
I can see Garnier doing that.
Yeah.
And then Winters looks at this guy and goes, "Musette bag." He goes, "Coach?" He goes, "Sir, it's Hall, sir. I was on the basketball team." And he goes, "Leg bag." He goes, "Prop blast got it, sir. And my radio and batteries with it." And Winters goes, "Mine too." See, this is something that it's very interesting. They talk about it in the book, how just about everybody lost their leg bags.
Yeah.
Because they were told that it was the best way to carry stuff, and, you know, It's a good thing they didn't, none of them lost their legs, as you know, if the bag was just pulled off of their leg, you know, so they got lucky from that perspective. But
yeah, absolutely. And then I think, and I don't know this, I'm assuming a lot of that was because the aircraft were flying faster than they were supposed to, that they failed. I never actually asked anybody if that's why the leg bags failed. But we know that the airplanes were flying way faster than they were supposed to drop these guys.
Correct. Again, we saw it recently we saw it just a few minutes ago with the pilot saying, "Okay, we're going too fast. You know, at this, you know, we're too low and too fast."
Yeah. You know, I always wondered if they weren't flying that fast, would the leg bags have held? That was just something I'm assuming they would have, but
they probably would have. Yeah, exactly. But what's interesting is Winter seems to know where his leg bag went. And he goes, "Mine's somewhere over there behind those trees." And Hall goes, "Okay." He goes, "Follow me." And they start moving towards a clear, like the woods. And then they hear gunshots. And then they just turn around. And Hall goes, "To hell with that." And they just run away. And then they find a place to hide. And Winters then looks over and he sees an anti-aircraft battery. And he goes, "Well, wait until after they reload." And then he waits a few seconds, and then he goes, "Go." And then the two of them run away to safety. And then we see just the two of them walking, and Winter says to him, he goes, "Aren't you from D Company?" And he goes, "Able, sir. Guess that means one of us is in the wrong drop zone, sir." He goes, "Yeah, or both of us." And then Hull goes, "Do you have a weapon, sir?" And he goes, "Just my knife." So, first of all, I see, as a former soldier, for me, it doesn't make any sense why any of them would have jumped not having their gun with them. Like, why would you put your gun in the leg bag? You want to make sure you have your gun if you're going to need to, you know, If as you're coming in for a landing, there's someone there, you need to be able to maneuver and shoot them. You're not going to say, "Oh, wait, let me get into my leg bag to get it." It like, you see, that's the thing that gets me a little bit, because if all these guys lost their Musette bags, right? I don't think every one of them had their guns inside, because we only find out that Winters, of the characters we see, only Winters and Lip don't have guns. Everyone else still has their guns. So it's just very funny that the commanders are the ones who don't have their guns on them.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And I mean, based on the response, I mean, it also shows that he didn't have a pistol or anything like that. It's just really strange. The only thing he has is a knife, which again, the knife makes sense that he would still have the knife on him, but still, makes you wonder why Winters wouldn't have had, maybe it goes to the fact that what Garnier thinks of Winters, that he's a pacifist, so therefore he doesn't need a gun. I don't know.
Yeah. That is I've never looked at it that way. I also didn't know I didn't know you were had served in the military. What branch were you in?
No, I was in the Israeli army.
Oh wow. Wow, that's cool. I did not know that. See, I learned something today.
There you go. There you go.
I always wondered how many if you watch so classic movie 12 O'Clock High. The US Air Force actually still uses that in its officer program training programs, that movie. And I always wondered if they ever use so in one of the Band of Brothers episodes, I think it's one of the ending of this episode, or it might be a later one, I don't remember, but they actually say that the tactics used by Easy Company are actually still taught today in training the US Army soldiers. And I
Okay.
always wondered if they ever use Band of Brothers at some points in their training. It'd be a fun fact to find out.
Okay, well, a spoiler alert, even though it's going to come later, I did an interview with somebody who is an expert on Band of Brothers, and he said that's complete bull. They don't teach that. They never taught it in West Point.
Oh,
And
no
they still don't.
kidding.
Yes. He says that he has
Huh.
no idea where they came up with this, but it's not true.
Oh.
So
All right. Well, image
tear down.
shattered for me for today.
Yes. Now, I mean, anyone listening to the next few weeks, you might hear me talk about it and say, that it is real, but I've subsequently found out that it's not. So keep that in mind. Yes. And then Hall says to him, "Do you have any idea where we are, sir?" And he goes, "Some." And as they're continuing to walk, Winter says to him, "So you're a radio man?" He goes, "Yes, sir." "Well, I was until I lost my radio on the jump. I'm sure you chewed out for that." He goes, "Well, if you were in my platoon, I'd tell you were a rifleman first and a radio man second." "Well, maybe you can tell that to my platoon leader when we find him. If we find him." He goes, "It's a deal." "Because first I need your help. We'll locate some landmarks to get our bearings. Keep your eyes peeled for buildings, farmhouses, bridges, roads, trees." And then he just starts laughing. He goes, "I wonder if the rest of them are as lost as we are." And then Winter says to him, "We're not lost, Private. We're in Normandy." So you've met the real Dick Winters. I've never met him, but I love the way that he's portrayed here. That he's I guess you could sort of say the perfect soldier, the perfect commander, because he's calm in this type of situation. He knows that he's going to be able to figure out where they are and get them back to where they need to go. He's not confused by the fact that they overshot their the drop zone or anything like that. As far as he's concerned, we need to now get from point A to point B, and I'm going to do my best to get us there. Doesn't matter where we are, and we're going to figure out how to do it. So I like that perspective, and the fact that he says we're not lost because we're in Normandy, that already says so much about it.
Oh, it does. I mean, and that was also him. I mean, very calm, not excitable. He did have a dry sense of humor. I mean, he did have a sense of humor though. And then and I love like so these guys don't, they landed and they're like, we've got to figure out where we are. on the opposite end of the spectrum, I got to interview Ed Shames, who was one of the Easy Company guys who jumped that night. And he said that when they were training on the big sand maps, you know, that they had, he said there was one area with a steeple, and that was like a place you did not want to land because there was a headquarters there. And he said, okay. And then it had a big label on it, and it said, avoid at all costs. And he said, well, when I landed in the airplane, the guy in front of me got hit, and it delayed the rest of us bailing out for a minute, jumping out. And he said, so when I did, I was far off from where I was supposed to land. And he said, I landed in a bunch of cows in a cow field. And he goes, right next to that steeple that said avoid at all costs on that map. And he said, thankfully, the cows were mooing, and that covered up any of my sounds. So I was able to kind of hide out and regroup and end up grouping up with about three other guys. So there was a case of he knew exactly where he was, but he didn't want to be there because that was a place you weren't really wanting to go.
Understandable. Definitely makes sense about that. That's actually how this segment ends. But I think it's great that they're showing us. I mean, obviously this really happened, but they're showing us how Winters dealt with the fact that he was separated from everyone else without a gun, and he's still doing all he can to try to figure out a way to continue with his mission. You know, it doesn't perplex him at all, which is just amazing to watch.
And it's also how calm and cool he is.
That's right. And that's the type of leader you want.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we can all imagine how Sobel would have reacted.
He would have yelled, "Hi-ho, Silver," on the way down. And
maybe.
Yeah. And I also love something that I always thought was powerful was the simple quote from Dick Winters on D-Day that is simply, "Follow me." Which, if you ever wanted to sum up him as a leader, it's that. It's follow me. He was always up front. He always was leading, never wanting anybody to do something he wouldn't do himself. And so to hear that phrase on D-Day is powerful, because even though he hadn't been told you're now a leader, you know, he's leading. It's only one guy at the moment, but there he is. You know, he's up front. And
I think he was always the leader. I think that's his personality.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
You know, he knew that this is what he needs to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, it makes a lot of sense that's what he would do. I mean, again, we talked about it just recently, just before. He was the first one to jump out of the plane. You know, he's not telling everyone, you go first and I'll follow. It's I'm going first and you come after me.
Yeah, I know it's a previous scene, but that scene was always so powerful, of him helping up all of his paratroopers to their feet. And that's what you want in a good leader. I mean, that's again, I feel that he is a good template for anybody, whether it's military or civilian world. If you want to study a good leader, you should probably watch Band of Brothers and study Dick Winters.
It's a showing of leadership in any situation. And that's what's so great about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, the men respected him so much.
I agree. And also never getting flustered. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I've had leaders in my life where when I see my leadership flustered, I get flustered. You know, it or at least it causes me like tension, you know, where I'm like, oh boy, like this is. But when I see my guys up front and they're like, okay, this happened, now we have to pivot, do this, you're just kind of like, oh, okay. You know, so there's a direct relationship there with him not freaking out, you know, to how everybody else is going to act when he's not freaking out. I at least, like I said, I'm speaking on my own, but I feel the same way when my leadership is calm and, yep, we've got this, no big deal, man, that, you know, that it's game changing.
Exactly. That's the whole idea. You know, that's the type of leader you need.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So today's segment is World War II movie trivia. We're going to play a little game where I'm going to randomly give you a trivia question about a World War II movie, and we'll see how well you know your World War II movies. So,
Oh, okay. I
mainly
have not
only
prepped for this at all.
there is no prep except your life of watching World War II movies. That's the only prep that you can really do for this.
Perfect.
In the 1983 movie To Be or Not to Be, what is the occupation of Mel Brooks's character?
Oh boy, I've actually not seen that one.
Haven't seen the original?
No, I've not seen that one. Boy, you're let's see. I can't even guess. I never saw that one. The 19 it was a 42. You're talking about like the 1940s movie, right?
No, right. So the 1942 one is with Jack Benny,
Okay.
and the 1983 one is with Mel Brooks, and they're both playing the same character, more or less.
I'm just since we're talking about it, I'm gonna guess that he's a soldier. But
No, they are both actors. They're
okay.
Shakespearean actors. The whole idea is that it's on the eve of the invasion of Poland, trying to help the resistance. They're both amazing movies. If you ever get a chance, you should watch them. They do it really well.
Wow.
All right, so let's spin the wheel for your next question, and hopefully it's a movie that you've seen.
Oh gosh, yeah. I'm sorry, boy, I apologize.
Don't need to apologize. Okay. Who plays the lead character in Van Ryan's Express?
Oh, Van Ryan's Express. Let's see, it's been a while since I've seen that one. Is that that's Sinatra, right?
Yes, it is. There
Okay, good. All right.
you
He was that, is that the one he's a P-38 pilot, right?
go. Yeah,
Okay.
he's a POW.
Yeah, the POW, yeah, but he was a P-38 pilot, I think. He gets shot. Yeah, okay. Okay, cool. All right, good. I redeemed myself a little bit there.
All right, let's spin the wheel again.
Not only that, but my Italian relatives would be ashamed if I didn't know a Sinatra movie, so
There you go. Okay, in the movie Bridge on the River Kwai, which character, played by Alec Guinness, insists on following military engineering protocol for the bridge's construction, even for his capture?
Oh, that is. It's Nicholson, right?
That's right, Colonel Nicholson. Very
All
good.
right, all right.
Excellent.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Yes, it really is.
So I'm getting ready for a Christmas break. You're making me a list of movies I got to watch here.
Perfect. Why not? Why not?
Wow. When I always think of the Bridge of the River Kwai, I also always think of Magnum PI for some reason, because I think Higgins built like a scale model of it or something.
That is okay. All right, let's spin the wheel again for your fourth question. Okay, who plays the lead character in the Steven Spielberg movie Empire of the Sun?
So you're talking about who plays the kid? Geez, what is his name? He plays Batman.
Yes, he
Give me a second. Christian Bale. All
does. Very good. Excellent.
right, all right. He was a really good Batman too, but love that movie. I got introduced to that movie when I was probably full, like really, I was probably in junior high. Like I was too young to probably fully understand what I was watching, but I loved the airplane scenes. And the older I get, the more I really love that. Even the scene where he salutes the Japanese soldiers when the sparks are all around the Zero, and it's just what a great movie.
Oh, it's superb. Superb, for sure. All right, so now let's spin the wheel for your final question. See, you're doing well. You're doing well here.
All right.
For your final question. Okay. Which 1944 film directed by Hitchcock takes place entirely on a ship carrying shipwreck survivors from both Allied and Axis forces?
Is that Lifeboat?
Yes, it is.
Oh, man. That was a deep cut. It's a really dumb reason I know that. It has nothing to do. I was researching Lifeboats over the weekend, and that came up, and I'm like, there was a movie called Lifeboat with Hitchcock. So that's the only reason I knew that one. Wow.
You didn't even know that. Okay, that's good.
I did not know that, other than I was doing research and stumbled on that. So
I got to tell you, it's an amazing movie. It's my favorite Hitchcock movie.
I've got to see it.
The whole movie takes place in this lifeboat. And then you have like 10 or 15 characters and all the debates between the characters and stuff like that. It's just amazing.
Oh, wow. I was reading about it because I'm like, what was this movie? For whatever reason, I thought it was about Titanic. I was completely reading something not related to the subject. And then I was like, there's a movie. And I thought it was maybe about Titanic. And then I was reading about it. I'm like, that sounds interesting. And I just kind of shelved it. And that was literally 2 days ago. So when you asked that, I'm like, oh, no way is this about that. So dumb luck there. Someone was looking out for me on that one.
Exactly. All right, now we will play the daily game of name that World War II movie.
Ooh, so, okay.
You know, I'll give you some basic information about a World War II movie, and you have to try and guess what.
Okay.
So, let's once again spin the wheel and see what we get. Round and round and round the wheel goes. Okay, this is a movie from 1970, and it is a biopic about one of the greatest commanders of the Allied forces.
Oh, that's got to be Patton.
Yes, it is.
Okay, great movie.
Exactly. All right, so Chris, would you like to tell people once again where they can find Chris Henry?
Absolutely. My day-to-day job here is I am the director of the EAA Aviation Museum here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. We have about 200 aircraft on display. Many of them are World War II era. So encourage you, if you ever get the chance, you're in the area, to come and visit us. And again, we're open every day except for a few holidays. And if you're a fan by the minute, movie by minute, I have done a few here. I've done Apollo 13, which I was one of the hosts with Jim O'Kane. But then I've been guests, thanks to this guy here, on a few, including the Die Hard minute, movie by minute.
Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, Saving Private Ryan, the Airport Minute. I'm trying to think
of
some.
That's Jim. I don't take credit for Jim. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I don't take credit for Jim either. So, but I've had a great time with Jim. Yeah, exactly. I'm a newer person at all these. I mean, I've done a lot of them, but there's one in particular I really want to host eventually, just because I think it'd be a fun one. And but I really have loved these. These have all been so much fun. It's given me a chance to talk with other people who are truly aficionados on the film and the subject matter. So I've had a great time, and thank you for always having me here.
Oh, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. A lot of fun. You give me so much information about planes and history and World War II. And come on, you're one of my connections to some of these great men that we're talking about, characters who are playing them.
So, well, I appreciate it. I feel that I had the honor of interviewing them, and that I need to honor them by sharing as much as I can about those interviews, and just every time you say their name, it just knows, you know, it's just more sort of remembrance for them. So happy to 100%. Do it. Thank you for giving me the platform.
Oh, I appreciate that. And thank you. Cause you're the one who got me in touch with George Luz Jr. in the first place. And,
Luz is awesome.
It's because of him that, that this season got made.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Finding me is very simple. Just do a search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So, Until tomorrow, curry!
Curry!